Call to order the House Committee on Elections and Rules on this 15th day of April, also known as Tax Day. If you did not know it was Tax Day, you are in trouble and should not be here. Colleagues, we will start off this committee meeting, as we do every committee meeting, with introductions of the committee, who and where you're from and what you're all about. So we will start down to my right, because it's easier for me to go to the right, if you know what I mean. Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve March. I represent House District 46, which is in the center of Portland. I'm in my third term, and besides serving on this wonderful committee, I serve on Education Policy Committee and Ways and Means.
Thank you, Representative March. Representative Holby.
I'm Representative Paul Holby. I'm from District 8, which is part of Eugene and Lorraine, Benita, and some rural areas of Lane County. I serve on this committee as well as the Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee and on the Subcommittee for Campaign Finance Reform.
Thank you, Representative Holby. Representative Thatcher.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kim Thatcher, Representative Kim Thatcher from Kaiser, just north of Salem. And I represent, my district goes up to Newburgh, essentially. I'm happy this is our last weekend on the road. No, I'm happy to be out here with you. It's been kind of a taxing
thing. I won't take that personally.
It's fun, but it's getting
tired. Moving on, Representative Farr.
Nice to be here in beautiful Grants Pass. I'm Representative Debbie Farr, and I'm from District 14, which is Northwest Eugene, Junction City, Cheshire, and Alvador. So I have urban and rural. And besides serving on this committee, I also have the great pleasure of serving with Representative March on the House Education Committee, and then I'm Vice Chair of Veterans Affairs.
Thank you, Representative Farr. I am Representative Derek Kitts. I'm the chairman of this committee, and from Hillsborough, Washington County. I will tell you in advance, as soon as we're done with introductions, we're going to stand at ease for about 2 minutes, and I'm going to go in the bathroom and take out my retainer that I had put in yesterday, because I can't talk with it in. So with that, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to be back home. I think I see a lot of very friendly faces in the audience for a change. I had to... that isn't the way it came out.
That is the way it came out.
That is the way it was meant.
We left Salem this afternoon, and it was, I think, about noon, and it was pouring rain. And I thought, boy, it'd be good to get back to the It's the Climate City. So we hope to have the folks here have a little chance to look around town while they're here and enjoy the beauties of Southern Oregon, and especially our Rogue Valley. As I came over Mount Sexton and started looking out into the valley, it really is fun to see the snow-capped mountains again and just the beauty of the mountains around us in our great little valley. I serve, as you know, here in District 3. I'm the chair of the Environment Committee and vice chair of the Land Use Committee, which will also be having a hearing in Medford tonight, so we'll be doing double duty, and I may have to duck out a little early. And I also serve on the Human Services Committee, which deals with the Oregon Health Plan and services to seniors and disabled people. So it's been a pleasure to serve you, and I look forward to hearing from you. Anytime you have a question, please do ship it in to us. I already got two or three from the DeBretts here, and so I really do look forward to hearing from each and every one of you.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. And since I popped out my retainer just there, we don't need to stand at ease. Colleagues, at this time, we're gonna kind of shuffle around the agenda. We're going to skip down to House Bill 3338, which is Representative Anderson's bill. And the Committee on Judiciary, I believe it was, has been kind enough to let us borrow the bill for the purposes of this hearing. We will not be moving it, but we will be vetting it out and hearing testimony on it. At this time, Representative Anderson, if you would like to testify on behalf of your bill in front of the committee, we would love to have you step forward and do so. Cletus, if you would read the summary of the bill.
Mr. Chair and committee members, HB 3338 directs State Board of Pharmacy to reclassify methamphetamines as Schedule 1 controlled substances.
Thank you, Cletus. I don't know if any of you were here for the presentation right before this committee, but it was dealing with methamphetamines, and very, very informative, the 10 minutes that I was able to sit down. So looking forward to hearing this bill and discussing it. So with that, Representative Anderson, please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for hearing this bill today. I am, for the record, Representative Gordon Anderson, representing District 3 in Josephine County, Grants Pass, and Cave Junction. There are over 20 measures on methamphetamine in our legislature this year. They deal with many, many different things. And as I understand from the Chair of Judiciary, we probably will be merging many of them into one committee bill and coming out with a comprehensive omnibus bill that will deal with many of the situations that we face with this epidemic that is out in our county, in our state, and in our nation. Before we came back to session this year, I had a time of a consultation with our sheriff and with the former district attorney. We have our present district attorney in the audience today, and through the graciousness of their office, I'm bringing this bill to the legislature. There are really a number of different ideas and items that are going to be covered in the omnibus bill that comes to us in the near future. The methamphetamine task force that had been called together, not only the Western governors, but also the governors from the West Coast, has basically outlined several main areas. One, to protect drug-endangered children and to make the laws for anyone that does in any way endanger a child, obviously through the use of methamphetamine, the penalties for such actions will be increased and made very stringent. Then also to there are laws that would be put in place that basically reduce the incidence of methamphetamine labs. Then in House Bill 3457, there is basically a forfeiture of personal property, much like the previous laws we had on RICO and Little RICO that were federal laws, that will allow the law enforcement agencies when they have clear and convincing proof, to allow a default judgment against someone who is a fugitive against prosecution for methamphetamine. And I think the reason for that is oftentimes people are arrested, brought before the court, and then they flee and you can't catch them. But this would give the ability to have forfeiture even if they do flee. And if they don't show up, then they're essentially saying that they are forfeiting anything that might be left behind. There are several other provisions. House Bill 2508 is basically talking about endangerment of the welfare of a minor, and that bill would increase the penalty for conviction to a 5-year in jail sentence or $125,000 fine or both. Pretty stiff. There's another bill that creates the crime of criminal mistreatment, and that means exposing a dependent in a way that causes physical injury. In other words, a minor child, if they're injured physically or especially with methamphetamine, and it's defined so that it does allow the methamphetamine crime, they also would be subject to a very stiff penalty. I believe in that case it's 10 years and a $250,000 fine. Unlikely that those are probably going to be left in to that stiff a penalty, but they may very well be entered in the early stages of the legislation. When Sheriff Daniel and District Attorney Johnson brought this to me, they basically wanted to just increase increase the classification of methamphetamine. Presently, marijuana is more—it's more of a crime to be violating marijuana use than it is methamphetamine. And yet, as many of us here in this county saw when Congressman Walden came before us about a month and a half ago, the seriousness of methamphetamine is 20 times more dangerous to our physical well-being. So this bill basically is very simple. It says that the Board of Pharmacy shall increase the Schedule 1 status of methamphetamine from Schedule 2 where it is now. This will put it in the same classification as heroin or morphine or any other dangerous narcotic drugs. And it raises it to the top level of controlled substances. Now, there is a problem with that in that there are some medications that use some of the substances within methamphetamine. For instance, pseudoephrine, they are used in some of the situations where children have ADHD. And so there are a few medically prescribed medications that will be excluded from this category. It will still be a Schedule 1 drug, but there are drugs within that category, one called Dixoxin, which is a medication for children to help them with their ADHD, that will be excluded. As I said before, I'm looking to this legislation to be merged in with probably maybe 20 or 25 other bills that will come out as the final omnibus. But that's the essentially the impact of this bill that I'm presenting, House Bill 3338. And with that, I'll close my testimony and ask if there's any questions.
Gordon, Representative Anderson, retrospectively, I'm going to open a public hearing.
And none of us caught it.
It's usually the way it goes. What do you anticipate? Obviously, if we, this is a huge problem. From Washington County, I can tell you that 100% of the identity thefts that the sheriff has identified as that being the crime is in every way tied to meth use. So it's a huge epidemic that's plaguing our state, plaguing our country, as you've seen Congress now take up as a result of the extensive work done by the Oregonian taking up this topic in Congress. What do you anticipate, I mean, if we increase to a Schedule 1 controlled substance, with the number, the sheer volume of meth users and people that are busted for this drug every day, what do you anticipate being the fiscal impact to our state, the cost to incarcerate these folks?
That's a very good question. And being as we're still in a downturn as far as revenue, although it is coming back, it would put some fiscal impact to the state government, both in Division of Corrections. The Department of Corrections would be impacted in putting people in prison. Whether this actually gets into the final bill or not, we'll have to wait and see. I know the governor has a high priority on dealing with the people who are abusing this, and especially that are abusing it in relationship to children. But we may not be able to get it this year, but down the line we're going to be working to get more and more and more of a penalty for those who are abusing this medication.
I will tell you, Representative, and I applaud your efforts on this topic. It's not an easy topic to discuss. It's very easy to simply throw out solutions to the problem, but to be able to vet them out and work them through the process with, like you've done, is commendable, and it's a big issue, and our state thanks you.
Mr. Chair, I might just say that the part of the bill that I mentioned, one of the other bills that is being proposed, does allow forfeiture of property, which will bring in fair amounts of money to be able to run not only the courts, but possibly even some of the corrections. We are, as you know, building a new jail in the Madras area. There's another jail in the Ontario area that eventually will come online. And we're just looking ahead and planning that unless we can cut down and prevent these problems, we're going to have to house some of the criminals that are perpetrating them.
I couldn't agree with you more, Representative. I think the cost to society as a whole with regards to these people out in the public, in the general population, far exceeds the cost that it would cost to get tough on this drug in this state and let people know that, quite frankly, you do the crime in this state, you're going to do the time. So, thank you. Okay. Representative Thatcher.
Just looking at the staff measure summary, and it was mentioning that under Oregon law, controlled substance schedules are determined currently by the Board of Pharmacy and are reflected in their administrative rules. And the schedules are based on apparently a federal Controlled Substances Act. So basically it sounds like the Board of Pharmacy right now has the ability to reschedule that drug. Have you talked to them about doing this?
Yes, I've talked to Mr. Holt from the Pharmacy Association, and he was the one that encouraged us to have the exclusion, but they have not made that move, and we're just encouraging them to up it to a Schedule 1 from a Schedule 2.
Follow-up.
They might well be able to do it, but they haven't.
Right. Okay, so this just would ensure that they would actually make that move.
Gotcha. And formalize it in legislation.
So no other questions at this time. I would just note for a side note that this drug that we're dealing with in this state is more addictive than heroin. It's the most addictive substance out there. It can be made with virtually anything, and that's what makes it so scary is the accessibility to this drug. So thank you again, Representative, for taking the time to testify. At this time, we will call forward Stephen Campbell.
Good afternoon.
Bringing the ORSs up on us.
I brought the ORS.
The actual laws. We're in trouble. Please state your name for
me. My name is Stephen Campbell. I am the district attorney for Josephine County, elected and began serving in January of this year. I'm coming on my own behalf or as district attorney and also testifying on behalf of Oregon District Attorneys Association that supports this bill. And we do thank Representative Anderson and the other sponsors of this bill. As has been mentioned, the Controlled Substance Act, there is a federal Controlled Substance Act that was adopted into the state rubric for controlled substances, and at the same time the Board of Pharmacy was given authority to also change that around. The general idea of controlled substances, the scheduling of them, is that the ones that are most problematic to society, that are most likely to be misused and abused, should be scheduled the highest. And for quite some time now, methamphetamine is our biggest problem in this state. It's causing more crime. It is related to more crime in this state than that may be an overstatement. Alcohol is still a big problem. Marijuana plays a part, but it is significant in particularly property crimes, as the chair just mentioned, the ID theft. It is appropriate to move this up from a Schedule 2 to a Schedule 1 because it is the drug right now that is most misused and most abused and causing the biggest problem in our state. And so we support that being done. Now, with that being said, this bill alone will frankly do very little for the prosecutors of the state of Oregon, because what controls the sentence that we get is this Oregon sentencing guidelines, and this bill does not change the Oregon sentencing guidelines. What the only effect of this bill standing alone would be that it would raise a possession of methamphetamine to a Class B felony, and therefore persons convicted of that would not be eligible to have that conviction expunged 2 years after they were off probation or after their sentence. So as Representative Anderson testified, this has to come in step with some other legislation to really be effective and help the prosecutors and the community really deal with this problem. And I really think that's all I have. I'm just speaking specifically to this bill itself. We do support other legislation, some that Representative Anderson talked about, and that a lot of that is still being defined, I think, through the legislative process.
Stephen, thank you for taking the time to testify today. It's always good to hear from those people, those that we're discussing affect. Colleagues, seeing no one else wishing to testify on House Bill 3338, I will be closing the public hearing on House Bill 3338. At this time, we'll be opening a public hearing on House Bill 2758. Representative Anderson, I believe this is another one of your bills.
Yes. I didn't realize we were going to cover both of them.
I'm here to help.
Yeah, that's great.
Cletus, would you mind reading the bill summary?
Mr. Chair and Committee, HB 2758 directs the Department of Revenue to establish general tax amnesty program of limited duration, raise penalties for taxpayers who pay outstanding taxes, takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment of the state legislature.
Representative Anderson, before I have you start, we had another committee member join us. I will give Representative Greenlick an opportunity to introduce himself.
Thank you. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick. I represent a district that includes Northwest Portland and goes all the way out into the what you may not believe is a rural area of that part of the area. And my district is right next to Chair Kitson's district, and I'm very happy to be here. I'm sorry if I was late, and I may leave early to make up for it.
I'm just the chairman. I'm not the babysitter. So whatever you need to do, Representative. Thank you for being here. Representative Anderson, please state your name for the record and continue on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I think this is a bill that probably will be very popular in my home district here because we would be much more in favor of people who owe taxes to pay those taxes than to have to raise taxes. And as you well know, our state has experienced a very serious reduction in the revenues that we have taken in over the past 4 years as the economy has had a major slip. Taxpayers are often caught without the means to pay taxes or just miss deadlines. Some are embarrassed or afraid to come forward and get so far behind because of penalties and interest that they hide. Some are also criminally negligent. And regardless whether they're criminals or whether they're just forgetful, they still owe the taxes. Again, there are several bills that are attempting to correct that loss of revenue this year. Senate just passed a bill off their floor yesterday or the day before, Senate Bill 480. And there are also two other bills, House Bill 2455, that deal with the tax amnesty or collecting those taxes in the most creative way we can think. But they also include a voluntary compliance initiative as well. And that's not just to bring in the taxes through an amnesty period of time where people can pay their back taxes and be relieved of any penalties, but that adds a complex part as well that says if they've been involved in an abusive tax shelter where they've been trying to avoid taxes fraudulently, that there is also a way for them to pay those taxes, get caught back up with the state. My bill does not cover that. Mine is just a tax amnesty, probably, again, maybe merged into the larger bill as it comes out of judiciary later in the year. But the idea behind my bill is simply to allow people a time, it'd be 3 months from the beginning of January until the beginning of March next year, give them time to pay those taxes. If they can't pay in a lump sum, then the bill allows them to pay out over a period of time, in fact, until 2012, 6 years. If they can pay in increments, they can pay, amortize it over a period of time. There would be interest, but there are no penalties. and that in itself is a major draw for many people. Many other states have done this. Illinois proposed it, passed it, and almost $100 million were brought in that relatively populous state. In Oregon, their estimates are that it several years ago was proposed, and they estimated that $5 million could be recouped. And the word seemed to be that the $5 million was low, that it more likely would have been $10 million. The recent estimates that I'm hearing is that it probably would be somewhere between $10 and $20 million that would be brought in if this bill were to be put in place. $20 million, as you know, would pay for bringing our community colleges back to wholeness. $20 million would go a long way to pay for seniors in the Oregon Project Independence, allowing them to stay in their homes rather than being forced out of their homes. And so I think even just a small amount from 10 to 20 million is worth going after. If you and I and the folks here have to pay their taxes, then those who are negligent in paying their taxes should be brought back in any way we can. The bill does say that if the time period of amnesty passes, then they will again be brought under the normal law, which would secure not only interest on the back tax, but also penalties. So I think it's a good bill, and I trust it should pass.
Representative Anderson, another great bill and great idea. Any idea what the total dollar amount owed to the state in delinquent taxes is?
I really don't. I would have to think it's probably in the $50 million category, and the 10 to 20 million might come in, but we won't get it all.
Sure,
it's a good start,
especially when the stake is wringing out every nook and cranny for every dollar that we can find in any place. So, thank you. Are there any questions for Representative Anderson? Seeing none, thank you, Representative. Is there anyone signed up to testify on House Bill 2758? Seeing none, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2758. Colleagues, at this time, we are going to open up everyone's favorite, House Bill 2583. Cletus, if you could read the bill summary of 2583.
Mr. Chair of Committee, House Bill 2583 requires evidence of citizenship for individuals registering to vote for the first time in Oregon. Declares an emergency to be effective upon passage.
Thank you, Cletus. Members of the committee, thank you for your patience. Cletus, do you have the sign-up sheet? No. This bill and the next bill that you will be hearing have been the centerpieces for our our statewide tour dealing with potential elections reforms and items that may or may not come up in our state to try to just make sure that our state doesn't end up as a Florida or as a Washington state, as you currently are seeing a debacle going on there even to this day. So, with that being said, I will call forward Art Harvey.
Chairman Kitts, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Art Harvey. I serve as Chief Deputy County Clerk here in Josephine County. I'd like to express my concern about House Bill 2583, which requires evidence of citizenship for persons registering to vote. While I do support efforts to strengthen this requirement, I think this bill goes too far and would make it very difficult for many of our citizens to register, perhaps nearly impossible for some. Here in Josephine County, our office serves as a passport acceptance agency. One of the requirements to obtain a passport is to prove citizenship. This is done in one of three ways: presenting a certified copy of your birth certificate, your original naturalization papers, or if you happen to have a passport or an old expired passport, that'll work as well. For the people that have these items already, this would be wouldn't really be an issue for them. But for those who don't, which I believe is most of the citizens, it basically would force them to spend money to become a registered voter. To get a copy of your birth certificate, fees go as high as $40 depending on the state and jurisdiction you need to work with, where you were born. And for our low-income Oregonians, that could be a great impediment, I believe, to registering. So the unintended effect of this bill would be to charge people to register to vote. Timing is also an issue. As you know, in Oregon, you can register to vote up to 21 days before an election. We hear stories from people getting passports from other states that it takes 4 and 5 weeks at times to get their birth certificate once it's ordered. There are also people who...
Main Street, then it is a process finding out if they're 18 years of age. Is that right? A gas bill, for example, showing they live at 123 Main Street,
right,
is not what you would use to find out if they were 18 years of age. Is that correct?
That would prove where they lived. That would have nothing to do with their age.
So that doesn't have to do with their age. And that also has nothing to do with their American citizenship, because a gas bill at 123 Main Street doesn't indicate whether they're an American citizen. Is that right? What about their age? How do you find out how old they are?
Well, they sign and they check the box that says they are 18 or will be 18 years of age by the next election, and they sign that under penalty of perjury, and that's what tells us they're 18.
So like a statute that makes them prove their age by, I don't know, taking rings of their body or something? I mean, is there
like a tree?
Is there some interest, would you say, in your friend? You feel satisfied somebody comes in and says they're 18, they're not some 14-year-old alien trying to pretend they're 18?
In our office, I don't believe we have an issue with that. I couldn't speak for some of the larger counties.
And if they walk in to their...
If I may, yes.
If they walk into the office and register, do you require that they mail you a gas bill?
No. If they register in person, that requirement isn't necessary.
How do you know they live in Claremont?
Part of the verification...
How do you know they live at 123 Main Street if they walk in?
Well, once they're registered, we send them a ID card, a verification card, to their address, and that will be returned to us. That's a check. That has to go and be received. If it comes back, then they're inactivated or removed, actually.
Right. Follow up? Well, then how come when they walk in, you send them something to verify it, but if they mail it in, then you have to wait till they send you something to verify it?
That complies with Oregon election law. The reason we do what we do with the mailing and notification and send them about it anyway is that's the way the Oregon election law is written.
Can I call again?
Please.
So then it might make your job easier if we change Oregon election law to treat mail-in registrations the same way we treat walk-in registrations.
As far as procedurally, yes, it would, but I think you'd be flying in the face of the HAVA requirements at that point.
I think for clarification, also the HAVA guidelines serve as the bare minimum that is required. We can expound upon that as the states see fit.
My understanding is that the Oregon election law supersedes the HAVA, and when HAVA was passed, there was an arrangement that Senator Smith and Senator Wyden were part of
that brought us to this system we have now?
It can't be bypassed. The bare minimum. You can't reduce the minimum requirements under HAVA. You can expound upon them, is my understanding.
I wouldn't know that for certain.
I'm sorry, Andrew. Go ahead.
It's fine. Thank you. So if I can just summarize and see if I understand this. To verify somebody's 18, if they walk in or if they mail in, they swear under the offense of perjury that they are 18. Mm-hmm. And in order to deal with their citizenship now, whether they walk in or they mail in, they swear under, what was that you said, $10,000 fine and 1 million years in prison or something, that they're a citizen. So the main problem you have if they mail in as opposed to walk in is getting certification that they actually live where they live, except if they walk in, you get that certification by mailing something. And if they mail in because of Oregon election law, then you have to get them to send you a copy of a gas bill or something to show.
That's correct. We do send that identification card to all registrants, regardless of how we receive their card. But the part about requiring additional documentation, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Farr, then Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many cases of potential or actual voter fraud have you encountered as a county clerk?
I'm a chief deputy clerk. I'm not a county
clerk.
And I've been here...
I stand corrected.
That's okay. I've been here almost 8 years, and I don't think we've had one.
Thank you. Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Harney, we had some problems in the last election around voter registration, and since this deals with the voter registration issue, the problem that was reported is that some people were paying a bounty on people to going out and registering people of one party or another, and then if they didn't vote, I mean, didn't register for the right party, they were throwing those away. So did you have any of that problem here? Harvey, I'm sorry, Mr. Harvey.
That's okay. Not that I know of. We had one person who thought they had registered through a voter registration drive, and they weren't, but there weren't a lot of them where we would have suspected anything like that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Harvey, I've got one question that's come to my mind, and I, as background, I was born in the state of Washington, so I can beat that state up. I was in Florida all 36 days of the post-election down there, and I will tell you that Washington State has come down to under, you know, I mean, it's in the hundreds of ballots. I can't remember the exact number, but 100-something ballots, and they just found 94 felons that voted, so on and so forth. So there's some very tight discrepancies. I'm not implying that a Republican statewide could ever come that close to the Democrats in the state, but what I am saying is if that were to happen, we're talking about a very, very slim number. And then in Florida, the presidential election was determined by under 1,000 votes. In not even the most populated state, rather the fourth most populated state.
7 votes at the term end, okay. 9 votes.
Thank you, Representative, you're out of line. we'll take the W any way we can get it. The number that you said was 274 people currently are on the rolls, people that have registered to vote but have not fulfilled the minimum requirement to do that.
Mm-hmm.
If you times that by 36, it's 9,864 people that could potentially vote but would not have fulfilled the requirement, whether a utility stub, whatever that may be. I know there's a lot of low-income folks out there, and that 37-cent stamp may prohibit them from mailing in one of the aforementioned. But does that cause any concern? I mean, those are large numbers of people that are currently... I mean, you're a lot smaller than my county of Washington or Multnomah County or Clackamas County, Lane County. I mean, these are big, so I'm only to assume, and we know what assuming does, but to assume that there are, in this category of people, a lot larger number in those bigger counties. Does that, I mean, does that give you pause in any way, shape, or form?
Well, I think, my own personal opinion is that that the intent of the HAVA requirements are sabotaged by the way we're told to do this.
I appreciate that. You've actually brought up some testimony here today that in seven other cities that we've been in has not been brought up. So I did not realize that if you did not provide one of the minimum requirements, you could still vote.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that has not been brought up in any testimony that we've heard. And that gives me great alarm. And that by voting in a federal election, now if in fact that's going to be the case, where if you vote in a federal election, you don't have to provide one of the following. It doesn't say that anywhere on here. I mean, I think either provide a valid photo identification, a paycheck stub, a utility bill, a bank statement, a government document, or participate in a federal election. I mean, that is no...
Can I ask a question at the same time?
Nope. Not right now.
I'm just trying to help you, sir.
I'm on a roll. I'm on a roll.
You're stumbling through here.
And I think Representative Greenlick brought up a good point, which leads me to my next question. And as chair, I get to ask them. If I walk in to register to vote, I'm going to walk through a complete hypothetical, and I want you to tell me what the process would be.
Mm-hmm.
I walk in to vote. I've got a baseball cap on, a T-shirt, shorts, flip-flops, and I walk in, and I want to register to vote.
Mm-hmm.
Fill this out. Yes. Sign it. Left my wallet in the car. Don't have photo ID. Get back with you. Fill it out.
Okay. Well, if you're in person, you won't be required to show ID.
So you don't even ask. So I fill this out, give it back to you. I leave. You mail me the card to that address that I put down. Would you then follow that up with a ballot, or am I required at that point to do something beyond?
No, you're registered at that point.
Don't know who I am. Don't know anything about me. I've shown you nothing other than I just walked in, filled that out, and then now I'm going to get a ballot in the mail.
The first step would be you get the ID card, and if that doesn't come back to us, then you'd be a registered voter. So in the next election cycle, you'd be sent a ballot.
Now let me ask you this question. If I walked in there and it was obvious, what if I sent my 13-year-old cousin in, who's obviously, to the visual eye, not 18. Can you ask him for ID?
I don't know the legality of it. I can tell you in our office we would.
Would you not then be in some type of a predicament that you're not treating everybody the same?
I don't know.
Representative Greenlee.
I was interested in following up on the federal election question I just mailed it in rather than coming in person. If I just mail it in, there's a separate process. And you said once they voted in the federal election, I was just curious as to whether you counted the federal election vote as well as other votes that were not a part of the federal election.
Their ballot is counted if they vote, whether they furnish the ID or not. The difference is if they vote in a federal election, it takes them out of that ID required category, and we won't send them any more letters.
That's a part of HAVA.
That's the way Oregon law has interpreted HAVA.
The other point that one of the bills that I'm looking at following up with this as a result of our statewide tour, the 72% of the 100% that are currently registered to vote. My thought is if they haven't voted in four elections, primary general, so two cycles, four elections, that you take them off, don't inactivate their registration, but that you take them off the automatic mailing. That would save taxpayers almost $2 per ballot, which is estimated the cost per ballot that when you mail those out. What would your thoughts on that be?
We do have something similar to that. I believe it's...
Don't know who I am. Don't know anything about me. I've shown you nothing other than I just walked in, filled that out, and then now I'm going to get a ballot in the mail.
Well, the first step would be you'd get the ID card, and if that doesn't come back to us, then you'd be a registered voter. So in the next election cycle, you'd be sent a ballot.
Now let me ask you this question. If I walked in there and it was obvious... I mean, what if I sent my 13-year-old cousin in, who's obviously, to the visual eye, not 18? Can you ask him for ID?
I don't know the legality of it. I can tell you in our office we would.
Would you not then be in some type of a predicament that you're not treating everybody the same?
I don't know.
Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, I was interested in following up on the federal election question I just mailed it in rather than coming in person. If I just mail it in, there's a separate process. And you said once they voted in the federal election, I was just curious as to whether you counted the federal election vote as well as other votes that were not a part of the federal election.
Their ballot is counted if they vote, whether they furnish the ID or not. The difference is if they vote in a federal election, it takes them out of that ID-required category, and we won't send them any more letters.
That's a part of HAVA.
That's the way Oregon law has interpreted HAVA.
The other point that one of the bills that I'm looking at following up with this as a result of our statewide tour, the 72% of the 100% that are currently registered to vote. My thought is if they haven't voted in four elections, primary, general, so two cycles, four elections, mm-hmm. that you take them off, don't inactivate their registration. But that you take them off the automatic mailing. That would save taxpayers almost $2 per ballot, which is estimated the cost per ballot when you mail those out. What would your thoughts on that be?
We do have something similar to that. I believe it's two general elections or 5 years, and they're inactivated, and we mail a notice before we do that, asking them what's up and are you still here.
Have you turned 18 yet?
Yeah, right. Appreciate that.
Are there any other questions?
Your guests don't come here.
Yeah. Thank you.
One more question.
Final question.
Well, it's kind of a follow-up to what you were asking. I could, like, same scenario. He could fill out his
Please
other...
Please use your own scenarios.
I like his scenario. And he comes in with his flip-flops and baseball cap and fills out... Gordon Anderson's name.
Mm-hmm. Way too young.
Well, you wouldn't know if you were Gordon Anderson or not. Because of your house. Okay, I mentioned this scenario because I've had different relatives and people live at my house, and that mail would come to our house.
Mm-hmm.
It would not be returned.
Mm-hmm.
And if it were to arrive, if somebody had devious intentions, their signature would match because they signed Gordon Anderson's name on this voter registration card, and perhaps a couple other people, and different registration drives. Anyway, you could have theoretically a house full of people getting ballots and being counted because nobody asks for ID or follows through with determining that person really is a valid person.
Conceivably, you could. The Oregon centralized voter registration system that's coming online is going to help a lot with that because it's going to ask for driver's license number, last four digits of Social Security, and it will do a check statewide for duplication. So that'll help a lot with that.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. You will ask the final question.
Thank you, and I will keep it brief. I know some other. I'm concerned because I think a lot of folks in this county and many of the other rural counties throughout the state are concerned more about the helping an alien to vote America than the helping Americans vote America Act. And let me just give you another scenario. Suppose we had an Algerian Frenchman who, through devious ways, stowed away and came to French Canada. Didn't like it in Canada, walked across the border, and made his way to Grants Pass, Oregon. Got a phone bill, you know, set up a phone, set up a gas account in the rental that he had. He's now able to come in, prove that he's someone that lives here. But that doesn't mean that he's an American citizen or that he's not maybe a terrorist. How do we protect against that with the system we have?
I don't know that I can answer that.
That's the problem we're facing, I think. Thank you.
Thank you. Art, you've been a trooper. Appreciate your willingness to answer the questions, and you've done a remarkable job. So thank you very much again for being here.
Thank you.
One small one.
You just come sign up. Yes. Yes.
Right now.
Come forward.
This is being recorded, so we need to have you.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. I won't convict myself.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Alfred Day. I am a citizen, and I confess that I didn't vote prior to 1996. I voted Republican.
So did I.
Bushionary, you know. And what I'm seeing since that time, and even before that time, is a huge increase in the number of illegal aliens. And that's my main focus for being here tonight. In Oregon alone, there's 90,000 illegal aliens. That number comes from the Federation of Oregonians Against Illegal, it's an acronym. Anyway, it's Oregon's Against Illegal Aliens, you know, we're trying to reform the bills. And what I'm hearing from the deputy clerk on that voting issue is that if some representative of those 90,000 illegal aliens had been sitting in there tonight, you'd have a real mess on your hands. Now, the two are not really legitimately connected. I mean, I realize that. But I'm just trying to sneak in my other comment so I can leave. And that is that I am very, very, very much concerned about illegals being treated by the media as immigrants. They drop the illegal conveniently, particularly in California or other areas. I would say L.A. is probably the biggest offender, you know. So when they talk about people coming across the border, they've lost the illegal status as soon as they step into Arizona. And, of course, that's why that group of people are down there trying to monitor that. But that concerns me, that whole issue. And it just happens to include the voting registration. That's all I have to say.
Thank you very much. Sure. Mr. Day, for being here and testifying on the record. Appreciate it very much. Colleagues, on House Bill 2583, I have to read something into the record, so if you'll bear with me, it's been a request that it specifically be read into the record. So with that, we'll go ahead and
make a statement when it's done, if I could.
Go ahead right now, Mr. Representative, if you want to make your statement first.
Yeah, I've never had the opportunity to be in Medford and make a statement on political philosophy, but... Medford. I have two more meetings in Medford, one tonight and one tomorrow morning, so I'm a little confused about where I am. You know, our society really works the way it works because we internalize the laws of of our society. Driving down here, I came up to a green light, and I didn't have to look to see if there was a policeman there to make sure that nobody was going to go through the red light so I could proceed through the green light. I knew when it was
a green light, we it's okay to go through because most of the people understand they're supposed to stop at a red light, and there's no enforcement in that. It's interesting, Representative Anderson's bill on tax amnesty, the most important thing about that bill is that basically we all pay taxes. There are a very few people who don't, and we want to ultimately do something about those. We pay taxes because we're citizens or residents and our duty, and we do it. When we swear in a court matter, we swear or affirm that we're going to tell the truth, and then the assumption is we're going to tell the truth, and most people do. The bills we're talking about here to try and operate in the assumption that there are a very large number of people who aren't going to be truthful, who are trying to corrupt the system. And it seems to me it's very important that we base our society on the faith that most of us are trying to do something appropriate because it's appropriate to do. And we couldn't live in a society if we couldn't make that assumption. I mean, it would be Beirut or Iraq at the worst time when that assumption is not there. And it really helps me as I go through life, having faith in that sense that when somebody signs their name to a document and says it's true, I'm willing to accept that it is true. And when it's not, I want to make sure we punish them. But it just, this sort of bubbled up in me today, and I thought it would be some, I haven't said it before in the committee.
I appreciate you bubbling. Representative March.
Mr. Chair, I have read the testimony that you have received, and if, since you've gotten it, I know it's entered into the record officially. In deference to the people who are here personally, I would ask that we put this at the very end of today's meeting and hear from the people that are here.
Thank you, Representative March, and in deference to the people that are here, as a request by other people that were not able to be here,
who have testified on this bill several times.
Realizing that, the bill, we'll read it into the record and take that 60 seconds to do so. Appreciate that. Are there any other comments? Thank you. Folks, what I'm reading is a response to the Oregonian's op-ed by the authors of this particular bill and have emailed me this and specifically requested that I read it into the record. So as an indulgence of the request, I will do just that. It says, in your April 12, 2005 editorial titled Punishing Illegal Immigrants, the operative word is illegal. According to Webster's, illegal means unlawful, criminal, illegitimate, illicit, lawless, wrongful. We are pleased your editorial cited House Bill 2583, which would require evidence of citizenship when registering to vote. As co-authors of the bill, we were not surprised that you failed to mention that it would only require evidence from first-time registrants, not every time, just the first time. We are reminded almost daily that there are adversaries who do not only wish our country harm, but also to change the way we live. So, is the fact that a birth certificate is not handy a sufficient and valid reason to risk the integrity of our electoral system on an honor or trust basis? In today's world, isn't that both inappropriate and naive? Currently, most voter registration is done by mail without any kind of person-to-person exchange, making the presentation of eligibility credentials a necessary requirement in a post-911 era. Just reading it. Furthermore, why should a request for credentials be regarded as punishment? Does an Oregonian reporter consider it punishment to show their press credentials from time to time? Oregonians deserve far better accountability from John Lindbeck, the state's election manager, than his claims that all is well because there's no data to prove otherwise. Indeed, it's likely there's no data, because available data has either not been sought or has been deleted. The problem is our electoral system is both faceless and devoid of any form of verification. The critics of House Bill 2583 need to be reminded how concerned Oregonians were back in the mid-1980s when the Rajneesh followers took control over the town of Antelope. Indeed, Oregonians were concerned enough to overwhelmingly vote in favor of a 21-day pre-election voter registration cutoff to prevent any such reoccurrence. Make no mistake, our country's adversaries are no less cognizant of our electoral system's frailties. Regrettably, the advent of vote-by-mail only and the loss of the polling place contact with both election officials and vigilant poll watchers has drastically diluted this safeguard. We have only to look at the electoral confusion in neighboring Washington state to recognize how vulnerable a system can become. A carelessness, sabotage, and fraud, especially when there is reliance on trust without the benefit of verification. House Bill 2583 is not meant to punish anyone. The Oregonian needs to step up to the plate and ratify their own position that illegal immigrants shouldn't qualify to vote by endorsing House Bill 2583. Without one-time evidence slash verification of citizenship, no one in this state truly knows a qualified voter from an unqualified voter. We urge readers to call their legislators and ask them to support House Bill 2583, Mike Balanese, Hillsboro, Oregon, Ruth Bendel, Portland, Oregon. Committee, thank you for your indulgence. That request has been granted.
Might help to put in the record that the people in Antelope all showed proper documentation when they tried to take over the town.
It's in the record now. Seeing no further comments on House Bill 2583, we'll close the public hearing. Colleagues, we'll now open up a hearing on House Bill 2551. Clerk, or excuse me, please. Dr. Clerk.
Whatever,
committee administrator, will you please read the bill summary?
At your service, sir. House Bill 2551 prohibits opening of return identification secrecy envelopes in elections conducted by mail until 8:30 a.m. Prohibits ballot drop sites established by persons other than elections officials.
Thank you, Cletus. At this time, I'm going to butcher it, and I apologize in advance. Alex Zeltme.
My name is Alex Zeltme. I am a registered voter. I have met all the requirements. I was fortunate enough to be an observer this last election for 12 days, of which most of those days were full-time from morning till close. I am in opposition of House Bill 2551. I've witnessed myself with six other observers from the Republican Party. I think there were three or four from the Democratic Party also that were involved. The process from signature verification to opening ballots all the way through the end, through the day of the evening of counting the votes. Before I go any further, I will have to say that the 20 people that were involved in opening up the ballot envelopes and pulling out the ballots, I still can't believe the amount of work they have done in the 2 weeks that I have been there. If that is taken away from them, if you wait till the election day to open up the ballots, it is impossible to find out what the results are going to be in 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 days. It will take 100, 150 people to open up the ballots in an 8-hour, 9-hour period. The security measures that have been put into place in Joseph County here, and I have to commend the Georgette and Art, they have done a fantastic organizational job, period. There were minor problems, but they are basically over-the-counter problems because, as observers, we not only watch the process, the opening of the ballots, the signature verification, but we also listen to the phone calls that come in. We watch the voters over-the-counter, what have you. And the professionalism that they handle things with is unbelievable. So I strongly encourage you to vote against this bill or kill it quickly. Okay, I don't want to wait 2-3 weeks before I find out who won.
Thank you, Alex. Are there any questions of Mr. Say your last name, Zeltme?
Zeltme.
Thank you. Seeing none, thank you very much for testifying. Next, in favor of the bill will be Georgette Brown.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm afraid you just misspoke.
Oh, I'm sorry. I must have misread that.
I'm Georgette Brown, Josephine County Clerk, and I am speaking in opposition to the bill.
What a surprise.
Why surprise? The delay, as was mentioned by Mr. Zelpe, the delay in not opening ballot envelopes until 8:30 a.m. on Election Day would drastically impact election night results. In a general election, instead of having 70 to 80% of the votes counted by 8 o'clock that night, we would probably maybe have partials of 7 or 8 precincts. In the last general election, it took my 5 boards of 4 people 1,351 hours to open and process our ballots. Each board member worked just over 67 hours getting the ballots ready to be counted. I have experienced dedicated board workers, and I mean emphasis on dedicated. Most of them have worked in the vote-by-mail process since 1988 in my office. If they only got to start opening on Election Day working 12-hour days, it would take them 5 days until the following Monday to process the election, and then election results would not be available until at least a week after the election. Now, my office space is limited. I could barely house the 5 boards. Usually in a small election like we're having, I have 3 boards or 4 boards. If I were to start opening election morning with any hope of finishing that night, I would have to employ at least 100 board members, most of whom would be new and inexperienced and would need additional training, which still would not give them the experience and efficiency of seasoned workers. Additionally, with our depleting county funds, the county does not have the resources to acquire the extra space that would be needed or the security measures that would be required in transporting ballots to a remote area. And I don't have the extra supervisory personnel. I have Art. He can't be in 5 places at one time. That would be required, not to mention the duplicating of supplies, equipment, an envelope opening machine, everything that would have to be furnished at another location. This bill would also, in essence, eliminate our 24-hour standalone job sites, which have been proven to be so well used and convenient for the electorate. We just would not have the funds to cover the bill's mandated 24-hour staffing of the drop sites. And then the requirement that the ballots be counted at the place of deposit would be a high security risk. I believe passage of House Bill 2551 would put the efficiency and integrity of the election process in jeopardy. So please abandon this bill. And that is my testimony, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Mr. Georgette, thank you. Representative Greenlee, I don't know if you, I know Representative Anderson is heading to his next meeting.
I
know that you've heard this bill 7 other times, so if you need to leave, we will probably be postponing HGR 1 until.
Paul, do you want to vote on? You're not going to vote it, sure.
No, we will not be voting on it. So.
Thank you very much. Let me just explain. We've been visiting around the state, this committee and other committees, and we have a land use committee in Medford tonight at 6, and then again, at 6:30, and then we're meeting this committee again in Medford tomorrow. Last week it was Hefner, Pendleton, and Baker City with 2 committees, and I'm very pleased to have been here, even for a short time. Thank you for your hospitality, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Help me with this, and just tell me why this is not possible. Why is it not possible to, on Election Day, let's just hypothetically assume that this bill goes into effect, why is it not possible for the county clerks to secure, by statute, let's say, a high school gymnasium on the day of election to be rented out, secured by the local sheriff, deputies, X number of folks. Obviously, it's an incurred cost. Rent for the day, the necessary number of letter openers, set it up, bring in the necessary, deputize the people that you would deputize to participate in that process to serve on your boards, and increase the staffing, a procedure set in place, either location big enough, tools needed, staff needed, security needed, if the state provided the funding under the Help America Vote Act. Why is that a crazy thought and wouldn't work?
Well, some of the things that I stated, okay, we would have to find 100 people, 150 people that we would have to train. Okay, I as I said, I have experienced, dedicated people that know how to handle the ballots, that know what they see, that know what to do. If we have to train inexperienced people, then there's a level of efficiency that goes away and of knowledge as far as what they're doing. And again, you talk about costs. I told you our county does not have any extra funds. They're cutting. I'm in the middle of a budget process. We don't have the funds to have the extra people, to have the extra security, to go to a high school and have all, you know, have that extra. And then, two, transporting the ballots. As the ballots are being processed that day, then you have ballots being processed at one place. You have to have different people at the office doing those, other people at, let's say, a high school. So, again, there's more people, more supervisors needed. It would not be efficient.
The cost argument that you stated, I preface that by saying if we paid for it at the state level through the Help America Vote Act funds that we would probably
I don't think HAVA funds cover that kind of thing.
I don't know that you're right on that, but Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I don't know that I'm right either, so.
I'll do one question and a quick follow-up. Are there some pieces of legislation or legislative concepts that you'd like to put on the record that would help the electoral process?
As far as all this is concerned?
Anything relating to elections.
Okay. Well, I mean, as far as the election process, the way the elections have been handled in Josephine County, they have been handled, I have to say, they have been handled smoothly. We haven't had a lot of problems. I do have dedicated staff, and we haven't, every time we've had a recount, the recount has come out just fine. We have good security. As far as that's concerned, the part that you were talking about earlier on the registration, there's some problems there. But as far as the election process, and I do believe the election process in most of the state of Oregon, I belong to an international association of clerks, recorders, and election officials. I know there are problems in other states, but we do not have those same problems in Oregon. I know it's easy to think about that when you hear about what's happened in Florida, what's happened in Washington, but we don't have those same problems in Oregon. And just because it happens there doesn't mean it's necessarily happening here.
Well, thank you. And a follow-up on that is I think that we have a good electoral process here, and since you have put on record there might be some issues around registration, please send those concepts to me, and if either one of these bills is moving, I'll be happy to submit it as a minority report to either bill. Thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of get the sense that the system isn't broken, so why fix it from you? But I'd like to ask, has there ever been any allegation of fraud or anything like that in the handling of these secrecy ballots or opening the secrecy envelopes that you're aware of here in this county?
Not of opening them, no. I mean, we have had people, you know, when we check signatures, that kind of thing, you know, maybe it's not the right signature, and then we investigate that kind of thing when the ballots come in. But as far as the opening and the secrecy envelopes, all that. The process is when these ballots are opened, the boards take them, they double count, they count to make sure they have the same number of ballots as the same number of envelopes, and they check and double check. And there are so many checks through the system. This is what, another reason why it takes so long to go through and to process the ballots. And then, as the gentleman stated, everything is locked up every day. It's double locked, so any ballots that have been opened are not available to anybody, not to a janitor or to anyone.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Thatcher, then Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had a conversation a little while ago about, you brought up some, if it is, I recall, some complaints that people's ballots, they complained that their ballot was missing or somehow not making it to your office, or they didn't get a ballot in the mail and they should have. I can't remember exactly what it was. I just wondering if you recall that conversation. Yes.
Today or?
No.
A month ago. Okay, I'm trying to remember that conversation.
Where people registered to vote didn't receive their ballot.
Oh, they thought they registered to vote. Okay. When people register at DMV or some of the drives, they think that they're registered to vote, and then we don't have them on the rolls, and so they don't receive a ballot, and then they come to us and they, you know, wonder how come they didn't get one and we don't have them registered. Recount has come out just fine. We have good security. As far as that's concerned, the part that you were talking about earlier on the registration, there's some problems there. But as far as the election process, and I do believe the election process in most of the state of Oregon, I belong to an international association of clerks, recorders, and election officials. I know there are problems in other states, but we do not have those same problems in Oregon. I know it's easy to think about that when you hear about what's happened in Florida, what's happened in Washington, but we don't have those same problems in Oregon. And just because it happens there doesn't mean it's necessarily happening here.
Well, thank you. And the follow-up on that is I think that we have a good electoral process here, and since you have put on record there might be some issues around registration, please send those concepts to me, and if either one of these bills is moving, I'll be happy to submit it as a minority report to either bill. Thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of get the sense that the system isn't broken, so why fix it from you? But I'd like to ask, has there ever been any allegation of fraud or anything like that in the handling of these secrecy ballots or opening the secrecy envelopes that you're aware of here in this county?
Not of opening them, no. I mean, we have had people say, you know, when we check signatures, that kind of thing, you know, maybe it's not the right signature, and then we investigate that kind of thing when the ballots come in. But as far as the opening and the secrecy envelopes, all that, the process is when these ballots are opened, the boards take them, they double count, they count to make sure they have the same number of ballots as the same number of envelopes, and they check and double check. And there are so many checks through the system. This is what, another reason why it takes so long to go through and to process the ballots. And then, as the gentleman stated, everything is locked up every day. It's double locked, so any ballots that have been opened are not available to anybody, not to a janitor or to anyone.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Thatcher, then Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had a conversation a little while ago about, you brought up some, if it is, I recall, some complaints that people's ballots, they complained that their ballot was missing or somehow not making it to your office, or they didn't get a ballot in the mail, and they should have. I can't remember exactly what it was. I just wondering if you recall that conversation.
We were talking?
Yes.
Today, or?
No.
A long time
ago. About a month ago.
Okay, I'm trying to remember that conversation.
Where people registered to vote didn't receive their ballot.
Oh, they thought they registered to vote. Okay. When people register at DMV or some of the drives, they think that they're registered to vote, and then we don't have them on the rolls, and so they don't receive a ballot. And then they come to us, and they, you know, wonder how come they didn't get one, and we don't have them registered. If we don't have them registered, we're not going to give them a ballot.
I think that one of the points covered in the bill is the drop sites for ballots, because we've heard from other testimony that in some counties they don't have secured ballot drop sites. For example, like in a library, they might have a secured site within the library, but then when the library is closed, people would just, you know, push their ballot between the doors of the library.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. So do you have any sites like that in Josephine County?
Okay, we don't have anything where you push your ballot through. We do have 24-hour standalone drop sites, okay, like a mailbox.
Right, so once the ballot is in there, it can't be removed.
It cannot be removed unless it's unlocked. And then the same thing, we have one at the door, one of the door, side doors of the courthouse, but it's actually like a mail drop box, so that they can put it in, and that's inside, but it's locked too. Now, we don't have anything where you just do that. In Cave Junction, they have a ballot box, and the recorder there is deputized by me, and he has a ballot box in front of where he works every day, and that ballot box is put in a safe at night.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Georgia. Thank you for your testimony here today.
Oh, and I do have, the county, I have written testimony from the county commissioners.
Can you give that to yes. Please just submit that for the record. I'd read it to Representative March, but I don't think he'd like it very much. This time we'll call forward Hal Anthony. Thank you for being here. Please state your name for the record.
Hal Anthony, Chairman, Three Pines Neighborhood Association. Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives, for the meeting. We're in support of Bill 2551, but as Chair, I do have some withholds and a couple questions about the wording on the bill. You'll see, as you look at that bill, underneath the summary, the last line of the summary prohibits, quote, prohibits ballot drop sites established by persons other than election officials, unquote. I'm curious how that will affect picking up ballots by political parties. For example, this last election cycle, there were at least two political parties I know of that were picking up ballots to deliver them to drop sites for disabled people and elderly folks. I know the Democratic Party was giving receipts to the people, and I think they have those still on file. Would that be effective? Would that be something difficult to do? And that's something I hope you can discuss as a committee before your final vote. I also offer my condolences to the County Clerk's Office. I have personal experience as to the degree of and the work ethic, especially from experience with Deputy County Clerk Art Harvey. They're good people, they work really hard, and I really sympathize with County Clerk Brown's withhold about the amount of work that would be added. And I would hope that the bill could go forward, assuming it will allow ballots to be picked up, and that HAVA could contribute funds to make this doable. So that's all we had on that, and my congratulations on being out from under retainer, so to speak, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you for the time.
Hal, thank you for your testimony.
Sir?
Did you have a question, Representative Thatcher?
I do.
Excuse me.
Well, no.
Go ahead.
I just want to verify I heard you correctly. You do support
I signed up for the support, but I would actually withdraw the support if that disallows a political party from picking up ballots for disabled and elderly people. I think that's a crucial role, and since you've got me sitting back down, I will throw one last, may I throw a closing comment?
Throw it.
As a chair, and speaking for myself also, I support anything that promulgates and engenders more participation, and that's why I'm not against Bill 2583. I think we're tilting at windmills when we're going overboard about a group of terrorists are going to come to the county clerk's office and try to register to vote. I think the only significant case of that ever having happened is with Mr. Rajneesh and his followers. Maybe karma is what killed him shortly thereafter. I don't know, but I don't think this is the threat from terrorism that we need to fear, and I think that what we ought to do, Republicans, Democrats, all parties, is do what brings forth confidence and trust from the voting public and engenders more participation in the voting process.
I agree with you. Thank you very much.
Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. Are you Jim Riddle?
No.
Oh, all right.
That's from the Board of Commissioners.
Okay, this is from the Board of Commissioners. I'm sorry. You said that you were chair. Are you chair?
I'm chair of the Three Pines Neighborhood Association.
Oh, okay.
And I will add that I'm gratefully not a county commissioner. Their workload is far beyond anything. I hope I never have to see anything like that. No, not Mr. Riddle.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Pat Hilton.
I've worked on elections back in Traverse City, Michigan.
State your name for the record.
Oh, Patricia Hilton.
Thank you.
Grants Pass, Oregon.
Thank you.
The American homemaker, because I'm the only one that thought of designing a career card, business card, for the work, because it's work.
There you go.
Okay. I was part of that back in Traverse City, Michigan, both working, and we'd work till 2 a.m. counting and recounting. And I have never been so concerned about good quality elections in this country as I am now. Traverse City, and I wrote my experience down, had one of the first electronic back in 1992. And even though there was the ability to recount, it was hideous. And someone had let a computer expert come in and say he had to fix the machine after the machines had been verified. I'm not sure anymore we have the ability to verify machines. They can be so carefully coordinated. I don't want to see machines here, or I want to see them checked. If there can be really checked, I mean, you could go up to 10,000 and have something kick in. Nationwide, the Diebold machines, ES&S, Sequoia, are all friends of President Bush and Cheney, and they're impacting 80% of the voters, and it scares the bejesus out of me, and I'd be as mad if it were Clinton. There is no way, and I don't see anybody adjusting that now. But please, in Oregon, keep as far away from machines as you can and the double count. And I'm just going to leave three copies of my experience in Traverse City, Michigan, and avoid it.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it. You can give it before.
Thank you.
To Cletus. Thank you for your testimony here today.
Yeah.
Glad I appreciate it.
Yeah, be an American homemaker, it says so.
That's awesome.
It is. I handed it out to 2,000 people doing a good job.
Thank you. Colleagues, seeing nobody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2551, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2551. In fact, colleagues, we have HJR 1, but nobody signed up to testify, so if it's to the agreement of the committee, we will postpone that until the Thriving Metropolis of Medford tomorrow morning. Seeing no objection, move to Medford. Colleagues, thank you. Anything for the good of the order? Thank you, everybody, for being here. Adjourned.